You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
Great. Well, I want to welcome everyone to the Shift in Action program tonight. It's my delight to be in dialogue with Hazel Henderson, who has one of those bios that most people dream about having. She's been a television producer of ethical markets, a worldwide syndicated columnist, author of books, editorials in 27 languages, editorial boards of journals, international this, international that. I mean, it really is quite a track record you've had, Hazel, in so many different fields, and really playing this integrative role about getting the big, broad picture of how our economic systems are reflecting our values or not, and how we can really chart a path to a more sustainable future. So just thank you so much for all the work you've done across a wide variety of domains,
and we feel very fortunate
to have you tonight.
Thank you, Stephen. Well, you know, I always felt from a very early age like I fell in love with the whole planet, and I really always thought that I was kind of a planetary citizen.
Uh-huh.
And I remember teaching at Esalen in the 70s. I had a little workshop which I called Planetary Citizenship. And there weren't that many people back then who really understood what I was talking about. But now I think an awful lot of people, particularly IONS members,
mm-hmm.
understand what planetary citizenship is about.
One thing I always like to start with, because people often don't have the backstory, and it's intriguing you mentioned Esalen in some of your early days. I'd love for you to just talk about what initially set you out on this path to where you are today and some of the primary influences that turned you into this kind of global economist.
Well, really, I think it was growing up in the beautiful English countryside, and actually it was during World War II, and my mother grew all of our own food, and we lived in a little town of 3,000 people on the coast, and she would take us down to the pier every day and go talk to the fishers and buy fresh fish. And so in a way, it was an amazing diet, and it made me realize that the earth was, you know, our main source of sustenance. And as I say, I sort of fell in love with nature, and that was kind of, I think, the start of it, really.
Was there a period where the traditional schooling system sort of led you away from that love, or was it just kind of a background?
Well, actually, I was very lucky. I went to one of those English private schools where girls like me learned how to arrange flowers. And, you know, we did art and music, and we did sort of rather like the Steiner schools. You know, we mm-hmm. did eurythmic dancing. I mean, we also had to do Latin, which I hated, French, you know. But in a way, it didn't sort of specialize one too much. And I think that that was help, and I never actually went to college. And so I really feel I sort of cheated, you know, because I have three honorary degrees now, but I never went to college.
that's a great story. And so so coming out of that background, I think one of the things that's just on the forefront of people's minds now is understanding what's broken with this big economic order, which is clearly showing so many signs of distress right now.
Oh, yeah.
And really, you know, because of you've looked at it from a very systemic standpoint, I wonder if you can play doctor for us and just diagnose what's wrong with the current economic systems.
Well, you know, I've been writing about this for 30 years, and I've always expected that the kind of financial crises that we're seeing today, and we saw really beginning with the meltdown in Asia in 1997, and then, you know, the meltdown in Russia and the default of Argentina and so on and so forth, you know, I always thought that those things were going to happen much sooner. Because I could see how inadequate the economic model in the textbooks was in mapping, you know, the full map of the resources and people and, you know, had this sort of very narrow kind of money-denominated view. And basically, what was always wrong with those economic textbooks, if I can put it very simply, is that they were equating money with wealth. And, of course, we know that money is not wealth. Money is basically colored pieces of paper that people, you know, use to track the real wealth. And the real wealth is, of course, the wealth of people, talented people, educated, healthy citizens, and the healthy ecosystem and the resources of the ecosystem. And so since I was very familiar with the ecological view, I could see very clearly how this very narrow money-based economic view, all about the gross national product growing and all of that, was going to lead us into this kind of trouble. And if you look at the financial crises that have been going on Wall Street since that meltdown of the two hedge funds at Bear Stearns back last August, it was so much, as one writer put it, an absolutely wonderful book that I do recommend, called A Demon of Our Own Design. And the guy who wrote that book, Richard Bookstaber, was he was really kind of a hedge fund quant in he was kind of, it was like the confessions of a hedge fund quant. And he was pointing out the truth, you see, that all these models are so narrow, these models that they use for risk analysis are so narrow that it was absolutely clear that sooner or later they were taking larger and larger risks which they didn't really understand. And so the whole thing began blowing up. And, of course, it was driven by ego and greed and all of those things that we know that humans get into if they're tempted enough. And then a little bit later, another wonderful book came along called The Black Swan, which is now on the New York Times bestseller list. And I've ended up being a friend of its author, Nassim Taleb, who also was a Wall Street options trader, a mathematician, and he's now retired from the field because he could see this whole thing coming as well. And he calls these risks that really the Wall Streeters were blind to, he calls them black swans because, of course, you know, people expect swans to be white. And so they're not ready for these, quote, black swans, which are all these risks which we create when we don't have a big enough model about what's going on.
So by having blind, like trying to narrow to make it simple, you actually end up making it stupid in a certain way because it's,
yes, exactly it, that. You see, and the stupid part of it, Stephen, is that, as you know, economists in their textbooks and models refer to all these things they don't want to pay attention to, like the environment, social costs, and all the rest of it. They refer to them as quote-unquote externalities, i.e. things that we want to externalize from our balance sheet and not pay attention to. And so it's like the perfect Freudian slip. And, of course, when you, quote, externalize all of these other aspects of reality, you end up trashing the ecosystem, creating social problems for people, and, of course, you end up creating financial crises and meltdowns within the markets themselves. And that's exactly what's happened.
Where do you go about undoing this kind of a habit pattern? Because I imagine some of it is a product of people's just conscious capacity to analyze complexity, as well as the system itself, what, you know, with the incentives that are designed in that to encourage this sort of more narrow
yes.
approach.
Yes, you're right. You see, we have to overhaul business school education. And it's very interesting now because quite a few business school professors are beginning to blow the whistle, and they're beginning to say, hey, we miseducated all of these MBAs that were coming off the production lines the last 20 years. We were telling them that was only a single bottom line. It was just about maximizing profits in money terms. And it was a very narrow, same thing, very narrow model. And, of course, now what we do in in the work I do in the financial markets is we have a triple bottom line. And this, you have to measure the company's environmental performance and its social performance as well as its economic performance. And so it's really interesting. I mean, if you look at the meltdown of Enron, I mean, Jeffrey Skilling, of course, is now in jail, was a perfect product of the Harvard Business School.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they were taught. And Fastow, who was the financial officer, he was a product of the Kellogg School at Northwestern. Mm-hmm. And I was up at Northwestern not too long ago, and the new dean that came in there about a year ago actually mentioned this, and he said, you know, we were shocked and horrified when we realized that this was the way we were educating people. And, of course, what we have to do now is go way beyond business schools. We have to go to all of the universities and get those economics professors to start teaching some of the new textbooks in environmental economics, resource economics, evolutionary economics, where you really look at how the economy is evolving. I mean, and that's really the part that I'm interested in. I belong to a group called the Association for Evolutionary Economics. And what we are pointing to there is that the old economic models, which are still running the country, assume that the society is in equilibrium. And here we are in a hurricane of global change, really, which we unleashed through the globalization and, you know, process. And here we are trying to manage the economy as if it was an equilibrium model.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how out of date the economic textbooks are. So, mm-hmm. I mean, just to get a little bit more, I mean, basically the issue is now, what is driving the system toward the kind of shifts that we IONS members know are going on and that we like to watch? And if you look now at the global economy, you will see the drivers of all of these shifts toward a greener, cleaner economy.
Mm-hmm.
And, gee, we can all enumerate them. Peak oil,
mm-hmm.
peak water. Now we have peak food, and we have peak fertilizers. You know, if you look at the current food crisis, this is a perfect example of this very narrow thinking that I was talking about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it began where we thought, oh, gee, okay, we will subsidize farmers to grow corn, to make ethanol, to put in our wasteful SUVs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we know that what that's done has been a very large contributor to this huge run-up in food prices, along with speculation, which now you've got speculation in all these agricultural commodities, as well as speculation in oil. And so things like this, you know, are a clear indication that the model that we're using doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. So would it be fair to say that this more narrow, traditional economic thinking was actually adequate to an era where humans were, you know, not maxing out our carrying capacity on the planet? And now that we're starting to hit those maximums, that it just literally has to force an evolution of the thinking behind economics altogether?
Yes, you're absolutely right. There was a time, maybe 300 or 400 years ago,
mm-hmm.
When the balance between human beings and the ecosystem was much more favorable, and we could mess around a great deal without causing too much ecological damage. But it's not purely the increase in population, even though mm-hmm. the human family is now 6.5 billion members. It's also the level of technology and the level of consumption that we are living in, and particularly in the Northern Hemisphere and in the United States and Europe and Japan. I mean, you know, if we realize that the Chinese, who we know are growing very rapidly now and industrializing and everything else, they still, per capita, are only using about 3% of the energy that we use per capita.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this is really the driver now is that, and of course it's really happening because of the price of gasoline. That's what's getting
right.
people's attention now. And
right.
and the fact that the dollar is going down because we created this global economy, and all of these investors from other countries can see that the U.S. cannot pay its bills.
Mm-hmm.
That we are consuming at a far greater extent than all of these paper dollars that we're sending all over the world to buy goods from other countries, mostly China. And, they're saying, hey, there's too many dollars out there. We think, we're going to start investing these dollars in buying natural resource companies, which they're doing all over the world, buying real assets. See, they used to buy our treasury bills. But
mm-hmm.
now, because of the way we are trying to pump up our economy, the old economy in the same old way by cutting interest rates, the international investors say, well, I can get much higher interest rates in Europe or Latin America or somewhere else, so why should I buy U.S. treasury bills? So
mm-hmm.
you see, that's why the Fed is now working sort of on this knife edge, going between trying to pump up the economy again and avoid the absolutely inevitable inflation or the decline of the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So this tells you that the old economy worldwide now is forcing us in the direction which I've been hoping and writing about for the last 30 years. I can't believe it. And what I call the politics of the solar age. We're right in the middle of it now, and that's the big transition from wasteful fossil fuels and unlimited consumption to the solar age economy, the clean green economy, which is perfectly doable, but we do have to notice the change and what we have to do to usher it along. And that's, of course, where we have a failure of leadership right now.
Hmm. When you talk about it, I sense a note of upbeat optimism about what we're transitioning towards, which is something a lot of economists in looking at the current order tend to be, there's more hand-wringing right now.
Yeah.
And it almost, what I hear is that you see this as a necessary corrective to actually get us on the right path for an emerging economics that is more sustainable.
Yes, and the thing that, I have to fully disclose, Stephen, that for the last 20 years, I have been a very patient investor in little solar energy companies and wind energy companies. And, of course, now I'm laughing all the way to the bank. They are the ones, if you want to clean up your portfolio in both senses of the word, getting out of fossil fuels and getting out of military contractors and getting out of all of this fossil-based economy, you know, including pharmaceuticals and that are all based on petroleum, then look on all of these new indexes that they're all at ethicalmarkets.com. I've lined them all up for everybody, and you can go on our green tech part of our website there, and you can find all of the market letters to tell you what to invest in. And the interesting.
So you've carefully screened all those personally, so that.
Oh yes, absolutely.
That's nice to have your.
Yes,
stamp
I mean
of approval.
Exactly. I mean, the ones that I've, the newsletters that I've chosen are really people who see this transition in the same way that I do, this huge shift from fossil fuels and wasteful kind of consumption brought on by those poor economic textbooks toward this much more efficient, cleaner and greener, and also more equitable economy, because you cannot really have a sustainable economy if it isn't more equitable. You know, if you have huge gaps between the rich and the poor, there's a lot of political instability that comes with that, and it is really isn't sustainable. So if you like, I can tell our IONS members who are on this call, the way I think that this new clean green economy is unfolding and the different areas of the solar age investments that they need to look at.
Sure. Maybe if you could, yeah, give some good practical tips that
okay.
people, I mean, because it seems like it gets to the really practical level of people who want to put their money to work in a good way.
Yes, absolutely. And so, you see, when you put money into these new companies, they are really kind of the pure plays of the dawning solar age, and it's really very exciting. And if you think of the whole range of renewable energy companies and technologies that there are out there, there is solar, and solar comes in two main forms. There's the photovoltaic companies that make those panels that you put on your roof, and you see now are up on those solar umbrellas on top of parking lots. I'm sure you've seen some of those in California.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole lot of them there. I think Google has the Google parking lot has is all covered with solar umbrellas.
That's what I've heard.
That's right. And I have several companies. I mean, I'm a small investor, you know, but I have several companies in solar photovoltaics. And then the other part of solar energy is called solar thermal electricity. And this is coming on very, very fast now. And it was invented by the Greeks 2,000 years ago. It's very simple. You just get a whole bunch of mirrors and in a desert area and focus them on either a big pot of boiling water, which turns into steam that drives turbines. I mean, I should back off and say that, of course, we all realize that generating electricity is very, very simple. It's about boiling a big pot of water and driving off steam, which drives turbines, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can boil that pot of water with oil or with coal or with natural gas, or if you're really stupid, you can build a nuclear power plant to boil the pot of water. I can't imagine why anyone would want to do that. And so in the solar thermal area, there's several announcements that are up on our website in the last two or three weeks where really this is the solar technology which can really go to scale. You can provide huge megawatts of electricity to run, you know, to feed into electric utilities. And so what you do here, instead of the whole ethanol mess where we've been taking good farmland and growing corn with lots of oil-based fertilizers and water and creating a crisis in the food system, instead of that, you can take desert land, which is no good for anything else, and put these solar mirrors on it and provide all the electricity that the entire country will need. And
well,
what it means really is that you have to have a smarter grid to deliver it from these areas. And, of course, it will be the same thing in the desert in North Africa. This can go all over the world. So that's the solar piece of it. The next piece
is that getting to be more cost competitive with some of additional?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, some of these solar technologies now are practically competitive with coal. And, of course, when coal has to buy carbon offsets to deal with its pollution or to try to do what the coal companies say they're going to do, which is to clean up the coal by sequestering the carbon and putting it underground. Now, nobody knows how to do that. But if you add those things into the price of coal, then the price of coal generation goes through the roof.
This kind of speaks to the externality question you begged before, because right now, until it's mandatory, carbon offsets are part of those. It's the carbon output is part of the externalities.
That's exactly right.
So as soon as you bring that in, all of a sudden these other technologies surge.
Coal is anything but cheap.
Uh-huh.
And that's why, incidentally, three major banks in the last month have looked at the numbers here and said, well, guess what? We're not going to finance any more coal-fired utility plants because you haven't added in these externalities, which we know are coming along the pike in the next couple of years. So the next part of the renewable energy field that people need to know about is wind energy. And in the central plain states of the United States, that's our OPEC of wind power. And the wind power companies now, I have an investment in a wind power company. The only problem with wind power now is that we can't manufacture the turbine blades fast enough. But some of these companies, like the one I'm in, which is called Clipper Wind Power, that went public about a year ago, and my investment came back tenfold. Helped me to support the work I do with ethical markets.
So there's a good example of good karma coming around.
That's right, yes. And then there's geothermal. And geothermal's been sitting there forever. And why weren't these technologies looked at before? Well, because oil and natural gas were just too cheap. Mm-hmm. Nobody would bother. So geothermal now is very big in the western states, and there are several geothermal companies, a couple that I'm invested in, are doing very well. And then there are marine current turbines, and this is something that's also been overlooked. And that is that if you put a turbine into an ocean current or a tidal area, it has about 800 times the thrust of air going over those same turbines in a wind generator. And so there's a nice little company that's just it's fairly well down the pike now in New York City, and they have put these marine turbines underneath the East River, and Mayor Bloomberg opened this whole operation. It's called Verdant Power. And the interesting thing there, they had two problems, very happy problems. The first problem was that the thrust of the tidal force on the East River bent the turbine blades. So they went back and made the turbine blades tougher. And then, guess what? It burned out the motors. So they are retooling now. But you see, this is all within the range of our understanding. Nothing has to be invented. And then there is better storage. This is a whole area now, energy storage. And mostly it's lithium-ion batteries, which are taking over from the old lead-acid batteries, and supercapacitors, which will be used for automobiles. And the biggest source of all, and the most important, is energy efficiency. And we have such an inefficient energy system that really about 40% of it can be tightened up. So it's like as we make energy efficiency improvements, it's like all those power plants that we don't have to build.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the sector now which gets me up in the morning.
Mm. So folks who are concerned about the current recession and other, you know, potentially even darker clouds on the economic horizon, it's really just more about where you're putting attention and focus right now, because there's some huge opportunities in all these sectors you're talking about.
Oh, just huge. And it's very easy to find all of this material now, although you won't find it in most of the mainstream financial. You know, they're still focusing on the old economy because, after all, that's what pays the bills. You know, it's mostly the big fossil fuel parts of the economy that buy the advertising and all of that. And so the other interesting thing is that because these companies are small, they are overlooked by pension fund asset managers, you know, who have to have larger size companies. So that's why they're really good for individual investors, because some of them are very inexpensive. And this is where you're going to find the next Googles, and this is where you're going to find the big winners the next time around.
Great. So I'd love to, we have about 10 more minutes before we open the lines to some other folks. So I'd love just to, again, move to that macro level, which you're so good at illuminating. And what would be some of the just very practical key legislative steps that we could do to shift the collective economics in a more positive direction?
Well, it's very interesting how simple this is. It all really revolves around energy policy, because energy is really the foundation of every economy. And I sent Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas a little thank you letter yesterday, because she had the guts. She was the first person in the Congress to have the guts to call for the end of the ethanol subsidies in the energy bill and the end of the ethanol mandates going into gasoline. And see, this is all being driven really by the farm lobbies. And yet,
and the fact that the first caucus is in Iowa.
Yes. And yet the whole thing is that farmers can do just as well by having wind turbines on their properties. And so we can just tell the farmers, look, don't worry about a thing. You know, good times are rolling for you now, and they will go on rolling. Just bring in wind turbines, and they'll be, you know, in good shape. That can replace any of the additional income they've been getting from corn-based ethanol. So that's really the first thing. Then the other thing in the energy legislation, which is absolutely key, is to extend the solar investment tax credits that we have in place now for a predictable number of years. You see, what the Congress has been doing is renewing those solar investment tax credits kind of on a two-yearly basis so that they can sort of feel good, hey, we did this again. But it creates a lot of uncertainty for investors. And right now, investors are coming into the United States mostly from Europe, but also from Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and wanting to put gobs of money into our solar and renewable technology sector. And because there is no certainty, it makes it, you know, less interesting to them, and so they take their money elsewhere. And that's really why Europe is way ahead of us. You know, Germany Germany you wouldn't think of really as being the solar economy, would you? And yet they created a huge solar economy in Germany just with predictable tax credits. And so right now our current energy system legislation still gives all of these subsidies to coal, oil, and nuclear, simply because those lobbies are so powerful. And at the same time, they expect the solar and renewable energy sector to kind of compete, you know, as if it were a level playing field. And so it isn't so much that we have to subsidize solar and renewables, because they're almost competitive at the moment, as is, but at least we should get rid of the subsidies, which are costing the taxpayers billions. Mm-hmm. And have oil and coal and nuclear make it on their own, and then you would have a level playing field. So that's what really, that's the most important thing that needs to be done.
Hmm. And how does that translate then down to the personal level? So folks who are, people can put their money in green investments or energy technology. What are some practical things that you recommend to people who really want to engage these economic forces in the most conscious way?
Well, they can also remember to ask their pension fund, whatever the pension fund is, if it's CalPERS or whatever, CalSTRS or wherever, to make sure that they are investing the portfolio in these new ways, just the same way as the Rockefeller family has just announced that they're going to do with their shares in Exxon. And that was very exciting to me, because they announced today that they're going to have a proxy battle at the annual meeting with Exxon to try to get Exxon to shift its investments into renewable energy. And so this needs to be done, and it can be done, you know, just if you happen to have a 401k or a pension fund. And then, of course, there's all of the green products that you can buy now, you know, not just the better light bulbs, but across the whole board, it's now growing so rapidly. And, you know, basically, it's also about things like going to farmers markets to buy fresh local food that hasn't been shipped using oil across the country. You know, anytime you help the local economy to close all of those loops, that this is another very good thing to do. Mm-hmm. And the other things that can be done is that you can ask your bank whether it has a solar program for mortgages. A lot of school systems now are being helped by tax credits at the state level to solarize and themselves, you know. And at the same thing too, in northern states, it's a matter of weatherizing and retrofitting old buildings. And here there was a wonderful program on Now, that's on PBS, half-hour show, and they did a program on how this is happening in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where they've now got a goal of refitting all of the public buildings. They're doing the City Hall and all of the buildings. They've got MIT and Harvard involved, and also individual homeowners. And it doesn't cost anything to retrofit old houses. What it does is there are upfront costs, but they pay for themselves in such a generally between, you know, 2 and 3 years, that the payback period. And so all they've done is got the local banks to guarantee these kind of loans and make them more available at every level. And so it can be done very, very rapidly. So it's not just green buildings. I mean, the whole green building and design thing is absolutely wonderful. And if you're painting your house or apartment, you can now get, green paints and the green floor coverings and carpets and everything. But also the big payoff is in weatherizing and retrofitting old buildings. And the triple payoff here is that this creates thousands of new jobs for people, you know, who are at the entry level. And there's a wonderful project that you probably know of called Green Jobs and Green for All.
I was just thinking of that, yes.
Van Jones.
He's an IAN fellow, so we love what he's doing.
Oh, yes, he's wonderful. Well, our company is a supporter of that. And so I think that this is the most exciting part, that this time when we create this new green economy, everybody will get dealt into the game.
Fantastic. Great. Well, I'm sure there are a lot of folks with questions out there since you have such a wealth of information. So why don't we actually switch into Q&A mode? And we have a new system now. So for folks, when I switch into Q&A mode, it just means you will be able to unmute yourself with *6, and then you can say your name and where you're from, and then we ask you to remute with *6 so we just don't get any background noise. So just be very aware of any background noise if you are unmuted, and I will switch into Q&A mode now. So hopefully most of you should be...
All callers are muted and may unmute themselves by pressing 6.
Okay, everybody should have just heard an announcement. And so if we open the lines for someone with a question or comment, their name...
Hi, this is Gina, and I have a question.
Sure. Hi.
I live in Sonoma, and what part will nanotechnology play, if any, in the green chip or green energy sector?
Well, there is a nanotechnology application. There's a company called NanoSolar, which I don't own. I'm not quite sure. I think what they're doing is they're using the silicon in a more efficient way than the way silicon is normally used, which is like very thin slices of silicon which go on those solar energy panels. I really don't know You can take a look at that company and find out. That's the only nanotechnology application that I know of in this field. But I think there are some real worries about nanotechnology. I know there have been some problems where they've used it for, you know, like household cleaners and found that it can be harmful because people may be inhaling these very minute particles, and we don't know really what the health effects are.
Great. Did that answer your question?
My name is Rich, and I live in Connecticut.
Hi, Rich.
Hi, Rich.
Hi. This is very interesting. It's a subject that I'm extremely interested in. I do have a question with regard to plasma conversion. There's a company local to Connecticut that I've been watching their stock, and it seems to fluctuate as low as a dollar and up to $3. And I'm just curious why that technology has not really done well, considering plasma conversion takes basically any type of garbage and burns it and creates hydrogen fuel, which in return can run generators, which can generate electricity. And why that technology isn't embrace, considering landfills are at capacity?
That's a very interesting question, and I've thought about that myself. I think a part of it is a phenomenon which I have noticed a lot in the whole renewable green technology area, and that I call the various orphan technologies, and it's just like they haven't captured the interest of Wall Street for some reason or other. Like for a long time, that was the case with solar thermal electricity. It was just a non-starter, you know, and nobody took any notice of it. Same thing with geothermal, and it could just be, you know, the bias of the financial reporters and editors. I mean, one of the things that that I've recommended, and it's there on my website, ethicalmarkets.com, on the front page, and that is that if you look at the way Wall Street is, and particularly analysts look at the economy, it's kind of looking at it in the rearview mirror, you know, the kind of fossil fuel rearview mirror, and they have these kind of asset allocation models, you know, that are the old sectors. You remember, you know, this real estate, and this retail, and this energy and transportation, and so on and so on, agriculture. And what has happened is that all of these little companies that are growing up in through the cracks, you know, in the green economy, are all dumped into these old categories, so that the solar energy stocks get lost in that big barrel called energy, which is mostly oil and coal. And all the little companies like Whole Foods, you know, they get lost in the category called agriculture. So what I'm calling for is a new asset allocation class, which is called the sustainability sector, which would give visibility to all of these companies across the whole range, you know, from the conversion of garbage to hydrogen and everything else. So that's what I think is probably the reason.
May I ask another question?
Sure,
yes,
go ahead.
Why not?
Okay. I've taken an interest in clean communities and green communities, I basically put together an idea for our local area to reclaim a landfill area and basically include this technology as well as geothermal and solar, and use the Connecticut River also as a micro or mini hydro power generation, and basically turn this into a energy creating green community that can be residential as well as retail space. Where would I even begin to present this to state officials? I have no, other than having an interest in this, and I've put together quite a nice proposal, who would I even bring this to?
Well, first of all, let me congratulate you, because this is exactly the kind of thinking. See, this is really holistic thinking, that you take a whole community and figure out how to connect all of those dots. And that's what gives you the synergy, as you know. And so I would just say that one of our advisors at Ethical Markets is very plugged in on this kind of holistic, sustainable community level. And she has kind of contacts which may be helpful to you. And if you would send me an email, I can put you in touch with her and see if she can suggest some places that you would go with this. She's been doing consulting work with CalPERS and with a big sustainable development in Southern California, where it's going to be a zero energy, zero carbon footprint new community. But I think what's exciting about what you're talking about is that you're talking about retrofitting, and that's such an important part of the whole thing. So, if you like, Stephen, I know can give you my email offline if you can get in touch with him.
Send editor at shiftinaction.com,
and
I'm happy to forward along.
Great. So good luck and congratulations. You're thinking smart.
Great. Let's get another caller in
Oregon.
Who is that?
John Miser, Eugene, Oregon.
Hi.
Well, welcome, John.
Hello, Helen. How are you doing?
Fine.
Yes, I have been thinking for many years about systems and metrics, and it has occurred to me that we might be able to have a lot of stimulus if we would just have a parallel accounting system that would track the energy input into our products.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, I mean, you're talking my language. I've spent a lot of my life on how do you correct the metrics, you know, at every level. And what's exciting is that we are beginning to do that now. You know, at the international level, we've got sort of carbon footprint and ecological footprint kind of analyses. And at the national level, we are beginning to go beyond GDP, as is written up in the 2008 shift report that ION's just put out. And, I have with the Calvert Group the quality of life indicators, which is another way of looking at the metrics at the national level. And then there's a lot of these metrics, of course, at the corporate level, the triple bottom line kind of accounting, and at the community level, and also, of course, you know, at the more personal product level, which you're talking about. And I think one group that you might get in touch with if you haven't found them is a group in Washington called Green Seal. And it's
Green Seal.
Green Seal. And it's just Green Seal, SEAL.org. And they are doing product metrics. And I can remember meeting many wonderful people around the world in the last 10 years, you know, who have the same understanding that you have, how necessary it is to have a label on all products that tell you what the energy input into that product was. And so we're getting closer now with this kind of carbon footprint stuff, but you're absolutely on the right track.
Okay, well, thank you. I have the connection I need, so I'll pursue it.
All right. And let me know what happens. You can always reach me through the website ethicalmarkets.com.
I will do so. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Another question. It's a star six to unmute yourself or remute.
Hi, this is Richard from New York.
Hi, Richard.
I manage a research platform for a large asset manager. And
Can't hear you. Could you repeat that, Richard?
I manage a research platform for a large asset manager.
Oh, yeah.
And I would be curious about whether there are public lists of whether ratings or categorizations of companies, either in terms of social responsibility or environmental positive effect, right? Anything to that effect.
Oh, are there ever? That's exactly what I do at ethicalmarkets.com. What I try to do is to aggregate all of these new indexes. And if you go to that site and click on the tab which says socially responsible investing, a lot of those indicators will pop up at the top of that page. And if you go to the tab which says green tech, you'll find all of the newsletters that I've been mentioning, you know, Green Chip Stocks and New Energy News, and there's a whole bunch of them there where you can plug in and see the performance of this sector. Now, there's another magazine which has an online version, which I have on that site too, which comes from London, called Environmental Finance, and they have all of the European indicators and these different indexes, and so they're just proliferating all over the place. There's the Clean Tech Index, and if you want to look at the technologies, you can click through to another partner of ours in Canada, called CleanTech, and the symbol is on our homepage. And so you should be on your way.
Okay, great. I'll take a look.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Another question.
This is Susan in Canada, in Hamilton,
Susan.
Ontario.
Hi.
Oh, glad to hear about CleanTech. That's terrific.
Yes.
I've got a couple of questions. One is about... well, there was a woman interviewed on one of these IONS presentations. I think her name was Catherine Austin Phipps or something like that.
Oh, yes, I know Catherine.
Okay, so how does that fit with this? Because she was saying, and, you know, it made me feel kind of hopeless because I just don't know enough about all of this to know, but she was sort of saying that any engagement in the financial markets is feeding what she called the tapeworm economy. So I'm assuming you guys, if you know each other, then you've sort of found some way around this issue.
Well, yeah, I mean, see, I think that the way Catherine sees it is a little different from the way I see it. I do believe there are all kinds of ways of playing judo with the dysfunctional economy.
I like this.
Because, I mean, I believe, you know, that we are in this financial system. I mean, it's all around us. It's global. My God, it's what's causing the food prices to go up all over the world. Just because people are speculating on the Chicago Merck, you know, it's hurting people in Indonesia and God knows what. And so I think that this is the way I find that one can play judo with it, and that is by being A, very, very clear about your own goals and values and your own vision of the green future, and then being very, very clear about assessing the companies that you want to deal with, do business with, buy products from, and make sure that you really have all of those metrics that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Like, for example, we don't, on my TV shows, we don't focus on any company which doesn't go through all of the screens of the socially responsible investment funds.
Right.
And I have an affiliate TV company in Brazil called Mercado Ético, and they use the same format that we do, except that they're doing programs about the green economy in Brazil. And basically, our model is to showcase the cleanest, the greenest, the most responsible, well-managed companies, wherever they are, and by showcasing them, helping to raise the bar for other companies around the world. And in the case of the Brazilian affiliate of ours, we have, I'm on the board of a company, of a nonprofit in Brazil, which is a group of socially responsible companies, and they do this social and environmental auditing for the TV show down in Brazil to make sure that the companies in Brazil are also vetted and screened to make sure that we only choose the best ones. And so the other main strategy that I use is that I always remember that money isn't wealth.
Right.
And so half of everything I try to do in life is outside the money economy. It's through relationships, friendships, reciprocity, partnerships, cooperation, sharing. And that's the way we're building our TV network. You know, if you're Rupert Murdoch, you have to go out and pay $100 million to buy a TV station. All we do is to find a TV station which has what I call a cultural DNA match with us, same goals and values, and then we sign an agreement and we barter programming. And so there's very there's all kinds of different ways to do this. And I have, if you're interested, on my TV channel, which is called ethicalmarkets.tv, I just put up a 9-minute little spiel that I did on this. It's called The Money Fix. And I think that that would be the best to help you see how I operate. And although I say I'm a friend of Catherine Austin Fitz. I have not seen her actually for 2 or 3 years, but I'm very sympathetic with her. But I have a different way of operating, and if you look at that 9 minutes, you'll see a little more clearly what my way of operating is.
Okay, thank you. Now, is that accessible from your website?
Yeah, you go to just go to www.ethicalmarkets, all one word, .tv.
Oh, all right. It's
and
right
you can
on the
watch,
way.
Or you can watch all our shows, including the latest one, "Growing the Green Economy," full screen on your laptop.
Cool. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Enjoy.
Ciao.
Okay, we probably have time for one or possibly two questions if there's still somebody out there.
Hi, Hazel?
Yes.
Hi, this is Zachary from Monterey.
Oh, hello, Zachary. How
hey.
Are you?
Good, good. I was actually in Esalen today. And it's.
Were you?
So greetings from Monterey.
Thank you.
Yes. And I'm just glad that you're out there doing what you're doing, and I'm happy to be a part of this all. As I've been learning more and more about what's going on, I'm really interested in how a community, how a city, how this a whole country and how the whole world, through community building, can improve itself kind of on an autonomous level. And there's a great inertia, as we know, against any sort of change. And my question is, you know, how do we talk to each other, our community leaders, our legislators, our senators, and mayors, and people who are in charge, in getting them to realize some of the difficulties that we're facing, and how to implement some of these fixes that we all know about. And so I just wanted your opinion.
Well. First of all, let me say, Zachary, you know, you are really on the right track. I mean, you know, it's clear to me that you know where you're going, and it's definitely in the right direction, you know, that this is the big challenge. And I must say that recently, over the past few years, when all of these solar and renewable energy company stocks started moving in the right direction and all that, I have been shamelessly, if I have to deal
with public officials,
right,
or people on Wall Street or in the business community, I shamelessly now push the money button, talking about playing judo with the money system. You really get their attention if you tell them, well, look, you know, this this isn't going to cost money. It's going to make money. You know, it's going to save the community money. And so don't forget that money judo game. The other thing is, and I agree with you, I mean, I feel right now what I'm trying to do is to put together a national sort of TV teach-in.
Mm-hmm.
To help, because, you know, the debate, the presidential debate, you know, is just so trivial, really.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to do is to help the American people to understand the new place of our country in this rapidly changing world and the fact that we are no longer the world's sole superpower. Now, most Americans do not understand that yet, and yet every issue that the candidates are talking about, from rising gas prices to home foreclosures to unaffordable health care and education, so on and so forth, job outsourcing, you name it, trade, is all symptoms of our new diminished role in the world. And the thing is that there are other power centers arising around the world, obviously in China and Europe. And the sooner that American people get to understand this, it's actually good news. It means that we don't have to run around being the world superpower anymore. Ron Paul is quite right about that, you know. And somehow or another, we have to begin getting that message through. And your guess is as good as mine. You know, it's really hard to break into mainstream media because, of course, they're all rooted in the fossil fuel age.
Right, and there is also the work that's being done by Jill Friend of Natural Logic.
Oh, I know Gil, yes.
Yeah, Gil.
Good stuff.
I met him the other day at a speech he gave in NASA, and one of the things that I've been thinking about and is seems pretty important to me is some sort of a feedback that we can give our community leaders, saying, you know, what you're doing is detrimental to yourself, and let me show you how, and give some kind of a automated feedback to them, and make it a friendly competition between local communities and national communities and international communities on who can be the best sustainable practitioners, who can be the most resourceful and conservative of their resources, and to be self-sustainable. And, you know, the kind of example of this is also in biofeedback, where you look at a neuro picture of your brain, and then you can affect it.
Exactly, yes. That's the right model, absolutely. And, I mean, some of the ways that it is being done is the sort of awards that people are doing now. I mean, there are all kinds of awards, you know, for green companies and awards for green communities. This kind of thing is very, very useful. And, of course, don't forget that we have an election coming up, and it really is important, very, very important, to change the composition of the Congress so that we get a few more votes in the Senate. Then all of these things can move forward. We're very, very close. But we really do need to change the team in Washington, both in the Congress and the presidency. And then I think we can move a lot of things forward. But at the same time, of course, you're right that there's a tremendous amount of leadership at the local level. And right now, I mean, the states are running ahead of the federal government. So it's really like at every level, it's kind of getting together with like-minded people, you know, sort of like different roles for different souls. Everybody has a place that turns them on and interests them. And so, you know, it's very much about community organizing, which I began in the 60s in New York when I started with some friends a group called Citizens for Clean Air. And back in the 60s, it was a vast wasteland. I mean, there was no Environmental Protection Agency, and nobody knew what the word pollution meant. And so we've made, progress. I guess that's why I feel optimistic that we're going to continue. So I'm with you, Zachary. Keep on doing what you're doing.
Great.
Thank you,
great
Zachary. Cover. And just we're past the top of the hour now, and we usually like to end on time, more or less. And so it's just such a delight to listen to you. It really lifts the spirits and opens the mind at the same time.
Thank you.
Because you just have a wonderfully optimistic view of the future while also really understanding the systems we're embedded in. And I find it very empowering. And the work you're doing is just fantastic. So thanks so much for spending this hour with us tonight. And people can keep diving deeper at ethicalmarkets.tv. And we hope to feature you again soon.
Thank you so much, Stephen. I really have enjoyed it.
Wonderful.
We hope you enjoyed this offering from the Shift in Action Partners program and would like to sample more. Partners of the Institute of Noetic Sciences gain access to a weekly stream of inspiration, wisdom, media, and spirited exchange. The program includes live weekly teleseminars with visionaries who are lighting the way forward, Marilyn Schlitz, Dean Radin, Belvie Rooks, Larry Dossey, Candace Pert, Brian Swim, and many more. Our live teleseminars are then added to an extensive archive of audio and video on our website at www.shiftinaction.com, with new offerings each week from teachers like Marianne Williamson, Edgar Mitchell, and Louisa Tisch. The site offers the latest in community-building software that allows you to engage every piece of content as a focal point for education, exchange, and action. Join us in exploring the frontiers of consciousness.